So good morning, everyone. This is week four of session 12. And as I mentioned last week and then wrote in the orientation, I have one more conflict in my schedule, which means that we're going to have to have another gap here. And I'm sorry for that. I will suggest something at the end of the phone call today or in the orientation about what you can do during that time. But the next phone call, and we only have two left after this, will be on September 20th. So September 20th and September 27th will be our final two sessions, phone calls, in this of the 72 that we will have done. So a little too early to congratulate everybody, but I am impressed with everybody, including me, that we've been able to keep this going for so long. It's great. Let me just give you my take, which is that we really have deepened our inquiry a lot during the course of these 2 years. I hope that people agree with that. If you went back and tried to describe it all, it might not be so easy. But I think just the level of the inquiry that we're engaged in now is really very high. Okay, the only other thing I want to mention is that Kyle, who normally posts the transition and the and also the phone call, the recording, and so on, is away for a few days. He will be back, I think, on Tuesday. So things won't be posted probably till Wednesday. Okay. So with that, we can get started. So we're dealing with very challenging, you could say, material. I mean, there's a lot of things here that I think requires some really careful reflection, and we'll talk about that. At the same time, though, I think there's some very concrete, very specific things that are happening in this chapter. We're reading two chapters, but I'm thinking now about the first chapter especially, and that's where we want to focus. There's a place in this first chapter, I don't have it in front of me right now, but we'll get there, I think, where Rinpoche says, well, maybe this just sounds like a bunch of words, you know, it just sounds so remote, and universal illumination, and which is what it says in the first sentence of this first chapter. It just sounds like, what does that have to do with anything? But he says, no, it absolutely does have to do with the immediacy of our lives. And one of the things that's really remarkable about this chapter that we're going to start with is that he's very concrete about what to do. It's not as though it's an easy follow the numbers kind of approach, but he gives a lot of very specific instructions and guidance in how to really approach this aspect, you could say, of knowledge. You could say great knowledge. That's not a term that's used in dynamics, and I don't want to mix things up, but probably okay. Here we're talking about the light dimension, knowledge as light. And, the more I prepared for this class today, the more I thought that when we say knowledge as light, my tendency anyway is to think of knowledge as radiant, like having the qualities of light, and that's accurate. But it's also true that light has the qualities of knowledge. That's what he's presenting here. And that means that light is not what we really think it is. It's not, yes, it's that, but it's a whole lot more. We're going to try to look at what that whole lot more is. So the first thing to start with, as usual, there's a lot to say just about the first sentence. In this case, we won't spend the whole we won't spend the whole phone call on it. Sometimes I feel like that's what we're doing. But in this case, it gets us started. So he's talking about the likeness, and that's a kind of a technical term here. He's using it in a specific way. The likeness of universal illumination. So, as I said, we say, well, what is that? What's, you know, how can we engage that? And this first sentence actually points us toward how to engage with it. And the way to engage with it is to look at our ordinary experience. You know, we don't go anywhere else, as we tend to say often in TSK, right within our experience. We start, our interest, let's say, is the likeness of universal illumination. And then he says that likeness does not readily manifest within conventional mental activity. And reading into that, what he's really suggesting is we would want to be able to manifest the likeness of universal illumination, you know, great space, a great knowledge, rather, in its light mode. We would like to be able to manifest that within conventional mental activity and sensing, he says. So all of our mental activity, all of our sensing, just the way it is, that's where we want to look. And that's where he wants to invite us to appear. Now, or invite us to go. And that's what the chapter really is about. And in this first sentence, he says, well, you know, that's not what our experience is usually like. We just have to be honest about that. And then he tells us why. Why? Well, the first thing he says is that you know, we have the field communique. So in the last chapter, last week, we talked about the light communique, and I think I pointed out that those two are kind of contrasts to each other. So in the field communique, things are communicated as being a certain way, and the way they're communicated is that they're objects that appear to a subject. That's the kind of knowledge that is communicated forward, or to use another word in from dynamics that we haven't talked about for a while, that's how things are conducted forward. So there are objects, there is a knowing subject, and the kind of light that's available to us is exactly the kind of light that reveals objects to a subject. And that means partly that it's physical light, because of course here we are with our senses operating, or well, actually the sense of seeing, and light bounces off of objects and into our eyes. So that's one way in which light manifests. That's completely consistent with the field communique that we embody or inhabit. And it has limits. Okay? So objects solicit our attention, and then there's this, you know, very key move that we make. We don't pay any attention to light. We look away from the revealing light to what is revealed. That's what the field gives us. That's what's communicated as being of value. We don't actually look at light. And I will say a little more about that in a while. But right now, the point here is that we look away from light. And I was describing this to someone yesterday, and they made they used a helpful analogy, and that was sometimes we have an insight, you know, and it's really striking. We say, oh, that's wonderful, and we write it down, or we tell somebody, or we try to remember, whatever it is. And, you know, the insight has its content, right? But, you know, so I had a great insight into such and such, okay? But it also has the quality of being an insight. And in some ways, that's more important. You know? I mean, it happens so often, it happens to me, and I'm pretty sure it happens to other people, that you have an insight, and there's kind of a glow about it. So there's a light-related word we're using. There's kind of, you know, it just has this wonderful clarity, and you know, it's just, that's what makes it an insight, right? It's aha, you know, the light dawns. And then let's say you write it down, and later you go back and look at it, and let's imagine that you've been able to describe the content very accurately. The content isn't so much what matters. Later you look at it and you say, well, yeah, I guess that's true. But the quality of insight isn't there anymore. Or maybe if you go back into it, you can reawaken the sense of insight. But the sense of insight is different from the content. And that's a nice aspect of this difference between the revealing light and what's revealed. You know, the quality of the insight is the revealing light. So we tend to look away from that. Insights are special because in moments of insight, the light reveals itself. I mean, it doesn't, you know, reveal itself the way that light reveals objects, but there is the revealing light, and we're aware of it in insight. So that's what we lose sight of. There's a lovely image here in this first paragraph still. In the next sentence, he says, okay, we react to what appears and we react to our reactions. So everybody's familiar with that. And then he says, we construct a world based on light as it is reflected off the surface of our constructs. Now, what I think is just wonderful about that image is that it's an exact parallel to the way we understand physical light to operate, you know, the explanation we give for physical light. Because, after all, and this is something I started thinking about preparing for this class, and I actually did a little research because I realized I didn't quite understand, and I still don't completely understand, but I'm going to share my partial understanding with you. When we talk about physical light, the thing about light that people tend to forget is that it's invisible. We don't see light. All that we ever see is the light that bounces off an object. Right? We see the light reflected off the object. And that's exactly what he's saying here. What we see ordinarily is not just physical light reflected off physical objects, but a world that's reflected off the surface of our constructs. So that's how the world appears to us, is it's reflected off constructs. Right? If we didn't generate constructs, nothing would appear in the ordinary sense. That doesn't mean we'd be without knowledge, and it doesn't mean that light wouldn't manifest, but it would be very different. It would be a very different form or kind of light. So that's why I think that's such a nice image. To go on with this question about light being invisible, that's something I've thought about off and on over the years. But the other day when I was, you know, reflecting on this, by the way, the word reflecting is you know, we use it mentally, but again, it's like it's exactly this image. Something gets reflected off something else. When I was reflecting on this, I thought, well, wait a minute. What if light's invisible until it bounces off an object? What makes it visible when it bounces off an object? And I realized I didn't really know the answer to that. And I tried doing some research on the web, and I didn't get a very good answer, really. The question kind of comes up, but I wasn't satisfied with the answers. But ultimately, I think I kind of understood, and that is that we actually never see light. Even after, you know, we say light is reflected off an object, but what we actually see is the photons of light, which are invisible, interact with objects. Mostly they're absorbed, but they're also partly then they're not absorbed, and so they're reflected off the object. And that's what we see. We see the interaction of the object with the photons, and then with our retinas. So what we see is not light. Light is never visible. But because it interacts with this world of objects, it becomes visible to us, and we suddenly a world appears. Okay, well, I don't feel that I still understand that so clearly, but it was interesting to me to realize that there's kind of a mystery just at the basis of ordinary.
Can I ask a question, Jack?
Sure. Michael? Yeah.
That seems like to be giving too much power to objects, that they're able to capture and reveal the light. It seems this whole way of looking at it is that everything is light. What is it about, is it a more dense or slowed down kind of light in our realm that reflects another more invisible kind of light, like something...
What is an object?
Yeah, what is an object?
Right.
That it's able to kind of reflect back to us another kind of light.
Yeah, it's. I think that's a very interesting question, a very good way of getting at it. It's in our world, that seems to be a kind of description. Now, as I say, if you go onto the internet, and, you know, I just Googled stuff and looked around for a while, and some things were on a very sort of popular level, and some things were by physicists. But people, you know, a number of people raised this question about, well, is light visible or invisible, and then what happens when it hits an object? And you see people giving answers, and they're all satisfied with the answers that they've given, but I wasn't completely satisfied. I think, what can I say about it? Because I don't want to spend too much time on this. Given that we live in the world, as this first paragraph is saying, and as we've seen many times, given that we live in a world in which objects appear to a subject, then light behaves in a certain way at the physical level to make that possible. And it's, you know, you're right, it seems like it gives a lot of power to the object, but actually it's just, I don't know, maybe you're not right. It's the subject-object complex. It's the world in which subjects see objects and light manifests in the physical realm through photons. All of that goes together. There's really no carving it out and saying, "Oh, the object is responsible for this." So, I was actually struck by how close this is to the analysis in Buddhist Abhidharma cult, so Buddhist psychology, you could say, because they say there's three different aspects in order for something to appear to us. There's the source, the object. There is the how do they describe it? There's the sense faculty which receives it, and then there's the transmission, the possibility of the consciousness. I'm not saying that quite right, and so again, I don't want to spend too much more time on this. But it was interesting to me to think about how close that is to a kind of Buddhist analysis. But let's move on. So there's a nice description here which will be familiar, like some other descriptions in TSK, but it should be familiar to you from your own experience. He says, when that's how we live, in which light has been reduced to substance, is the way he says it. And that's actually kind of interesting, because that's maybe related to what you're saying, Michael. What happens is light, you know, we do give power to the object. We don't think about it that way usually, but we say, okay, the object is responsible for its own appearance because it interacts with light. So in that way, light is reduced to substance. And then it talks about how that works in you know, the world that gives us is a world where we experience confusion and heaviness, distraction and agitation, restlessness and irritation. You might say, well, wait a minute, what does that have to do with the fact that I see, you know, the plant in front of me? Well, it does. I'm not going to try to go into it more than that. But it's worth exploring the physical light and all of this quality of a certain kind of darkness. He calls it no light, or I think, does he call it dark light here? He does somewhere. Yeah, a dark light. That's the world we experience, right? And what we discover is, there's this nice paragraph at the top of page 210, which is, which let me read it. He says, so we're talking about living in a kind of a darkened realm in which light has been captured by substance, you might say. And that's true on the physical level, but it's also true on the level of the self as substantial. I see Michael shaking his head because he's on my video, but we won't go there unless you want to say something. Michael? Yeah, you're muted.
My son offered me a smoothie through the window.
Oh, I see. Had nothing to do with anything. Okay. Okay. Well, that's I won't try to weave that into the class. Okay. So let's look at the top of page 210. As thought stumbles along in the darkened arena it has constructed. So this is giving the power to thought, but it's the same thing. It's in the realm of the mental and the realm of the physical. We'll look at that later if we have a chance. Okay, so thought stumbles along making its guesses as to what must be so. Well, it only manufactures more darkness. Out of the lengthening shadows, a host of voices emanates, mumbling and complaining, accusing and explaining, chattering or rambling or making shrill demands. Untraceable and unowned, their steady murmur becomes the background for our being. Well, that's a lovely, poetic, and somewhat depressing description of our situation. And it would be worth making that into a practice, actually. I mean, just looking. When I say making it into a practice, all I mean is, do you say, well, this is just a poetic evocation? Or can you, in fact, find that in your experience, this kind of mumble and rumble of thoughts and voices and complaints and so on? I think there's something there to look for, but we won't do that right now. Okay, now, we've set up the problem, the situation. And of course, you know, that happens over and over again in the TSK vision. You say, here's the problem, what can we do about it? And the whole theme, you could say, of our program is about activating the vision. So doing it differently, you know, not staying within that darkened, gloomy realm. In the text, it goes on to say, well, we could try to escape, but we can't really escape because, you know, escape, it's sort of like, I don't know, it's like if you're in a video game, the only way to, let's imagine, it's a video game, and ultimately the only way to escape is to stop playing the game. You know, wherever you go, you're still inside the game. And it's sort of like that. We're living, you might say, within the field communique. So he says, there's nowhere to go. So we can try to ignore what's happening, but then we're just absolutely guaranteed that things are going to go on the same way. So then the rest of the chapter, really, just about the whole of the chapter, explores, and actually in a surprisingly systematic way when you look at it, what we can do. So it starts on the last paragraph on page 210. He says, the alternative, right? So what's the alternative? The basic answer he gives is to investigate our situation lightly. Now, Rinpoche plays again and again with these two meanings of the word light in English, and he's certainly using both of them here. He's saying we bring more light into the situation, but it also means we investigate lightly in the sense that we don't commit ourselves. You know, we don't commit ourselves to the positions that we've accepted. You know, and instead we really determine, resolve. And the word resolve actually comes into play later. We resolve that we're going to go back to light. He says, you know, our thoughts and experiences can trace and embody their source in light. And he says, when we look there, instead of staying committed to appearance, to the way things are, to what light reveals within the field communique, when we do that, that awakens a sense of delight. So we enjoy it. We have fun. We find more ease, he says, and more balance. And we move naturally toward light. Okay. So that's the kind of general advice that he gives. But he's going to get more specific. So one kind of specific thing, it's not exactly in the text, but it's implicit, I think, in this whole paragraph, this whole discussion, is we don't hold the positions that we normally hold. You know, we see, this is something we've looked at in the past, instead, you know, we look at positioning, or we engage the positioning instead of the position. We don't hold tight, we don't take a position, we don't posit a situation. These are all things that have come up in the past. And especially the position of the self in the way that it reacts to what it experiences. So that's a kind of implied version, I think, when he talks about tracing experience to its source in light, and finding more ease and more balance and becoming lighter. So that's kind of a general bit of advice, something we could do. But he goes on and he's actually going to get more and more specific. I mean, that one, as I say, is kind of implied. But if you look at the top of 211, he says, how can we do this? Can we really activate this light genesis, the source of everything in light? Can we really activate that? Can we explore this possibility not as a theoretical construct, always the wrong move in TSK, not as a theoretical construct, but as a more subtle, dimensionless aspect of what is here for us now? What's interesting here, that might just sound like it's how do we get to the dimensionless aspect? I don't know, geez. But he gives us a clue here, so this is kind of a second thing that he points out. He says, we start with our own inner concerns. From there, can we open a cosmology of light? I've wondered why he uses the word cosmology there, but it strikes me that it relates back to what he says at the beginning of the paragraph about a light genesis. You know, the world has its origin in light, and the cosmology of this light universe, or it originates in light. But we don't have to worry about that. I'm more interested in the other aspect. We start with our own inner concerns. Right? And this is a theme that begins to get developed. It requires some kind of careful reading to see it, but it's absolutely there. The theme is that light is not just a question about what appears, but about what we care about what matters, about the activities of the mind. So the place we look, the place we start, is what we're concerned with, our own inner concerns, because that's where the energy is. Right? So that's a starting point. Now, he goes on, and now he really gets specific. He says, okay, so here is the discipline. This is the second paragraph on page 211. The discipline that could lead to such likeness is a simple one. So he's going to tell us, nothing mysterious here. It starts with fully inhabiting the situation we find ourselves in. Yeah? So this theme of inhabiting our situation is one that also comes up a lot in TSK. But here he gives us an interesting pointer. He says, we acknowledge the possibility of kind of freeing ourselves from the gravity of our ordinary way of being. We acknowledge this possibility in the moment we confront the darkness in our lives. So what he's saying, and this is implicit in a lot of this discussion, or explicit often, to inhabit our situation is to be attuned to the ways in which we experience confusion and agitation and emotionality and a sense of limitation and all of these things that are characteristic of our realm. So inhabiting our situation, you know, there's an aspect of it where you'd say, well, you know, be aware of the beauty of nature. That's inhabiting our situation. And yes, it is. But here he's really saying we need to inhabit the ways in which we have shut things down. We need to confront the darkness in our lives. So that's what he's suggesting we do. And the question, of course, is how do we do that? Well, he says, in the depths of the darkness. So we have to let the darkness come in. In the depths of the darkness, there are traces of clarity. So we'll look at what that means. I see that Michael has made a comment. So he says, when we were studying the field communique, I wondered if the field was an ultimate of knowledge communicating with us in our ordinary lives. It's quite exciting to encounter the light communique as a way of peering more deeply into a realm ordinarily hidden. It's almost like being able to step across a boundary and look around in a magical realm before being drawn back into the human realm with a bit of mystery clinging to our embodiment, inhabiting our situation with eyes adjusted to a different light. Well, that's very nicely put, and I think you're right. I think there is a difference between the field communique and the light communique. I mean, I'm very fond of the idea of exploring the field, but you know, ultimately you need to do that with a sense of the more fundamental, let's say, light communique, because the field communique closes us down. And yes, we become aware of a different light. You know, our conventional light is a light which guarantees darkness. It comes along with darkness, but not in the light communique. So that relates to this point that we're going to now. In the depths of darkness, there are traces of clarity. That would be the light communique, you know, remains available, you could say. So how do you find those moments of clarity? And he does, again, he gives an answer here. He says, drawing on moments when this clarity makes itself available. So it sounds like the clarity is there first and it just somehow shows up. Well, maybe that's right. Maybe it's always trying, you might say. Like light is constantly available, and so if we just every now and then, almost by accident, we notice it. You know, you might put it that way. There are traces of clarity. But he also gives a more specific, it seems to me, a more specific approach. He says we can refuse the old answers and the views that are thrust upon us. So you go into the old answers and views, and there's a moment, I think what's being suggested here is that at any moment, really, we're always about to accept what we know is the case. You know, we're always, the answer is always readily available. That's what it means to inhabit a field, right? To accept the truth of the field communique. So from moment to moment, we're constantly accepting that. So what happens is we just notice that we're about to do that. And you see that you don't have to. That's what he means, I think, when he's saying we can refuse the old answers and the views that are thrust upon us. We don't have to commit ourselves to them, right? Instead, we align ourselves with knowledge that expresses the light communique. So how do we do that? Well, there has to be a willingness to do it, and there has to be the intention to go beyond our ordinary answers, as he says, the intention to affirm our full livelihood. So here's a place where we start to see the connection between what appears to us, which is, you know, the physical world, but also, you know, thoughts appear to us and many things appear to us. But this other dimension, which is an aspect of the mental, of willingness and intention. Right? So what as I said, this gradually emerged for me as I was looking into this and thinking it through. he's really saying that light manifests not only in appearance, but in our, I don't have the general term right now, but in our willingness and our intention, those are also light manifestations. You know? And he actually, I think it helps clarify that in the middle of that last paragraph on 2.11, he says, each moment can be pure in both appearance and intention. So that purity of appearance, that's the light communique, or the light manifestation, or what did he call it at the beginning of this chapter? Universal illumination. I don't quite remember the word. So that's the appearance aspect. But there's also the intention aspect, and light manifests there as well. So I think that's really interesting. And the word pure is you know, it's a when the word, when the right word is available, you know, use it. So it's a nice word in English, but I think it probably is true in most languages. So in English, you can talk, you can actually talk about pure, like a pure white light, you know, or like lasers, or you know, have a pure because they're on a single wavelength. But of course, you can also talk about your intentions being pure. So that word is available, and that's exactly what he says here. Each moment can be pure in both appearance and intention. You know? So, and then he says purity. You know, that's the way to engage the traces of light, right? That's the way to set aside our darkness. You know, that we confront it, and then within it we discover the purity. And Ken asks, could light manifest as inquiry, as light motion? Yes, I mean, I think that implicit in this, in a certain sense, is that we're talking about inquiry. You know, inquiry is the intention willingness not to accept the usual answers. And so that means it's implicitly, it's an inquiry. You know, it's a questioning what we know is the case, which is really fundamental in TSK. And, you know, in Western thought, there are possibilities like that here and there, but, you know, they don't get developed very systematically. No, we don't have to go there. So yes, definitely a kind of inquiry. And you say light motion. I'm not quite sure what you mean by that, but if you mean that, you know, we set something in motion through our inquiry, then yes. Okay. That leads to something very interesting at the end of this paragraph. He says, we activate consciousness as transparency and resolve, that has to do with our willingness, resolve as radiant indestructibility. So those are, you know, they're very strong terms, and I think he's suggesting that it's something, you know, it doesn't depend on what shows up. It's indestructible in the sense of whatever appears, that willingness and intention which is pure, and pure in the sense that it activates light awareness. That's available, and it can't be destroyed. It's indestructible. So Ken has a couple of different variants on light motion. I think light dancing in the light time. Yeah, he does. Yes, I won't say anything about that. Yeah, the aliveness. And then John says, when inquiry is based on the already knowingness of light, then it manifests as creativity. And he capitalized the word base, he says here, when inquiry is based on the already knowingness, to emphasize it. Okay. So inquiry based on the knowingness of light. And that really, the knowingness of light, that's really what we're trying to understand and clarify here. And yes, it manifests as creativity. So moments of creativity are also, they what can we say? They embody the clarity. They're traces of this underlying clarity, you could say. Okay. So that's not all. Rinpoche is still, he's exploring this theme. What can we do? He says, we want to investigate our situation lightly. And he's asking, how can we do that? And then he asks, what's the discipline? And we start with an inhabiting. So let's go on just a little bit more. And this is the place that I referred to at the beginning of the phone call when he says, perhaps this sounds like words without substance, descriptions cut loose from experience. What does such a light have to do with the light we awaken to each morning? This is ridiculous. And he says, you're not going to get an answer on the level of ideas. And then he gives essentially another way of engaging this. He says, the best reply is, mind is available. Look directly there without preconception or preconceived limitation. So just look, just be willing to question, refuse the usual answers. It's all our experiences here. Light is available. When you do, he says, and this is interesting, this is a whole other aspect. He says, when you do, there comes an experience of warmth or heat, an intensity of energy. Already at this moment, you are close to light. Now the path unfolds on its own. So this is a suggestion that you would actually discover a kind of, I think he's again describing a kind of physical reality here of warmth or heat. Let's not do that because we're running out of time. It's something for you to look at. You've got several weeks now. There's so much in this part, in this first chapter of the two I've been reading. Kind of step by step by step by step. He's saying you can do this and you can do this and you can do this. So mind is available. Just look. And when you do, when you refuse to accept the ordinary answers within the realm of mind, then there actually is an experience you can point to and say, yeah, that warmth, that intensity, that heat, that energy, that's leading in the right direction, you might say. So there is a little more. Some other suggestions that he makes. And we could go in more detail, but I'm just going to go to what he says on page 213. At the bottom of 212, actually, okay, he says, once we engage the position, so we engage it in the sense of inquiring into it, right? Once we engage the position, we find ourselves amidst the prevailing patterns. So we haven't gone anywhere else, as we saw at the beginning, and this is generally true in TSK, you don't aim for some special experience, maybe in some exercises, but, in our kind of fundamental inquiry, here we are, it's just the way things show up for us, but we refuse to accept them. We refuse to accept the usual answer. Right? We observe with new clarities. And then we see how we tend to react. We have this reactivity. Right? And he gives a kind of a little description of someone who's doing this inquiry. Right? He says, this is... right at the top of 213, we react as we've been conditioned to react. We discover that this reaction is its own position. For a moment, so this is someone who's doing it lightly, right? For a moment, we gaze at this position and at the thoughts and other patterns that accompany it. Then we enter it. So we don't just, it's interesting, we don't just accept it in the sense that it slides on by and it's like we get on board that bus, It's more like we really enter it, we engage it fully. We enter it fearlessly conducting forward, and what happens? Do we find ourselves in this space of peace and bliss? Not necessarily. He says, well, actually what happens is we activate a stream of thoughts. We circle through rings of thought. We expand the standard ways of knowing. We neither accept the thoughts as guides nor reject them as enemies. We grow intimate with the byways of the ordinary. What a nice phrase that is. So we actually are almost stirring up our usual reactions, but we're entering into them in a new way. It's really a wonderful description of this possibility. And notice that this, again, this is like, it has to do with appearance, and it also has to do with intention. It has to do with, for instance, our emotions as they arise, but it has to do with our sense of, here I am in inhabiting this world. It's all set out in advance. Appearance and intention come up together. We do this with any of it. We do this fearless conducting. Now, this is where I would have done a practice, but we don't really have time. So I'm just going to keep going because let's keep going. We've covered. The way that I carved it out, and this is not the only way because I left a lot of things out. But there were 8 different steps or 8 different practices, you could say, that he suggests here. And we've been going through them, and it's not like it's your assignment to go through and figure out what 8 I had in mind. You can do it for yourself. But there are lots and lots of practices. And I want to make sure, especially because we have this gap now and you could work with this, that we cover them, as it were, and we mostly have. So we're still on page 213. And then he says, it's a dynamic progression, right? We activate, we enter into the patterns, the positions that we have, and we just keep going. We go right into the heart of it. I won't use that image. So that's what he's been describing. And then it keeps going. He says, we grow intimate with the byways of the ordinary. Through this emergent intimacy, our journey changes character. So this is a new step now, an additional step, right? Through this emergent intimacy, our journey changes character. Starting from the ordinary light of day, well, it's interesting, it's kind of recalling to us. Remember on the previous page, he says, opponent, as they would say in Buddhist texts, some opponent says, well, this is all just a bunch of words without substance, descriptions cut loose from experience. What does this have to do with light that we see when we wake up in the morning? And so he's referring us back to that. He says, so we start from the ordinary light of day, but we find now that we've entered the light-filled womb of experience. Here we can abide, embracing the truly unknown, allowing the presence of a lucent awareness. So we embrace the unknown, we go into the known, we plunge into it fully. We embrace it. And when we embrace it, we find that what we thought was known is unknown. And we abide in that unknown, which is the light-filled womb of experience. Very interesting. We tend to think of the womb, as completely dark, at least I do. But he's saying, no, the womb of experience is radiant with light. Light's fundamental, not darkness. That's the next step. And he says, well, we could just stay with that abiding. But he says, no, then we're going to fall back into limitation. I don't know exactly why he says that, so you could think about that. Leave that up to you. How would that lead to description and limitation? Well, I suppose the remaining maybe has a tendency to do that. But let's move on. So he says, we don't just abide. We abide for as long as it may be, which is kind of time changes. Maybe it changes. Maybe it becomes a very different kind of experience. But we abide there. But we don't stay. We don't remain with this abiding. Instead, he says, we set forth again. We open and embody all that we encounter. So this is a very kind of precise instruction, but it's also you have to explore how it might be possible to do this, right? Whatever you encounter, you open it. Well, we've already kind of had that sense. You open it in the sense that you don't accept the surface appearance, right? And you embody it. So remember, he used the word intimacy here, and we become intimate with the byways of the ordinary. And actually, looking at this now, I realize that kind of ties into the exercise intimacy from the first TSK book, where you say this too, that too is I. It's like that. You open it and you embody it. It's not separate from you. We open and embody all that we encounter. The light that makes seeing possible becomes our guide and our companion. So that's a shift. We don't stay with the abiding. So he's going step by step by step by step. So there's one more step. And he says, eventually there is another shift, and we become light. A vastness light, without words or names. The obstacles, whose names and qualities we know so well, change their character and lose their identity. Does that mean they disappear? I don't think so. It might have to do, maybe along the way that happens. But really, they're there, but they've changed their character. They've lost their identity. There's no naming and no testifying. The usual voices fall silent. Seeing discloses the vastness of light. The dynamic of power merges with the expression of experience. Mm-hmm. So, when that happens, when we become light, so that's the final step in this process, right? Then something kind of unexpected, at least for me, something unexpected happens. So at the top of 214, in this lucent knowing, there is nothing to be presented, no images to call forth and pass on. That's consistent with what we just looked at. Our conflicts and our confusions, even our neuroses, can embody knowledge. As distinctions yield their substance, true mercy can emerge. So that was the surprising part for me. Mercy. Wait a minute. Where does that come in? I guess my sense, but this is something for you to reflect on, definitely. I'll just share my sense. Is mercy has to do with not accepting identity, not accepting the truth of what's been so. There's a readiness to transform whatever appears. I guess since it just popped into my head, I will share a line from Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice when Portia is arguing for mercy for her client in this trial that they're holding. And a very famous line, she says, "The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven." That's what made me, and that's why I think it's worth reciting. It's like gentle rain from heaven. Nobody has to do anything. I mean, yeah, you can explain how rain happens, but that's totally missing the point. Now it's raining, and it's gentle, and it's refreshing, and it's alive. And why is that possible? Because there is nothing you have to hold on to, right? Mercy has to do with not holding on to anything. That's why it's related to forgiveness. So there's nothing to be presented. There's no images to call forth and pass on. Everything embodies knowledge. There's nothing to do. That's why I think you can talk about mercy. Okay. So the second chapter, I will take... a minute to talk about. Actually, Let me just point out a couple of things about it. One is, and I mentioned this in last week's orientation, he brings back in ekgnosis, and I think it's interesting to compare the previous discussion in this book in Dynamics of ekgnosis. I think that might give you a different or an added development. And then I just thought it was an interesting example that he gives to right at the very end of the chapter. He says, and he's talking about doing nothing, which is related to what we were just saying about mercy, right? Just right before where he talks about, well, he's been talking about doing nothing, nothing to be done. So in the next to the last paragraph on 222, he gives an interesting example. He says, suppose that we are asked to listen to silent language. Though we take this to mean that we must attend to silence as the opposite of sound, I mean, that's true. If we gave that instruction, we said, okay, listen to silent language. We'd say, okay, well, I've got to listen to the silence. Okay, how do I do that? He says, that's not what it means. We take this to mean that we must attend to silence as the opposite of sound, but silence has little to do with sound or its absence. So he's making a distinction. There's sound and the absence of sound. And that's what we would normally call silence. But he's really saying the quality of silence, like the quality of mercy, is not strained. It has nothing to do with the absence of sound, fundamentally. And that would be worth looking at and seeing if you can practice with that. Silence has little to do with sound or its absence, with images and their absence. It's only because we need to confirm and measure, evaluate, and examine that we restrict the meaning of silence in that. Okay, well now you will have several weeks, and I think it would be a very good thing to do two things maybe. Let me suggest two things. One is to go back through this kind of complicated, I mean it's complicated, but it's so joyful and filled with promise, the unfolding that we've been looking at. To go back through it, work it out. The places that speak to you, work with them, try to bring them into your practice. That's kind of the walkabout, I guess. That's one thing. And then the second thing is this second paragraph, or second chapter, obviously I skipped over most of it. Maybe you would like to discuss it among yourselves on the web page. I think we have to stop there, and we'll meet again in a couple of weeks, 3 weeks actually, or even four. Anyway, September 20th. I'm sorry for that gap. But we'll figure out a way to go out with a bang in those last 2 weeks. Okay, thanks everybody.